Welcome to PMA Takes on Tech, the podcast that explores the problems, solutions, people, and ideas that are shaping the future of the produce industry. I'm your host, Bonnie Estes, Vice President of Technology for the Produce Marketing Association, and I've spent years in the ag tech sector. So I can attest, it's hard to navigate this ever-changing world in developing and adopting new solutions to industry problems. Thanks for joining us and for allowing us to serve as your guide to the new world of produce and technology. My goal of the podcast is to outline a problem in the produce industry and then discuss several possible solutions that can be deployed today. This season of PMA Takes on Tech is brought to you by Plenty. Plenty is an indoor vertical farm that sustainably grows produce using less water and land than traditional farming and no pesticides or GMOs. The farm is able to grow peak season, flavorful food year-round and deliver fresh produce to its retail partners daily. Plenty's proprietary towers and intelligent platform make it the only vertical farm that can grow multiple crops with consistently superior flavors and yield. Today, we dive deep into genetics and CEA. I talked to Mohamed Ofatol, the newly named Chief Technology Officer at Revel Greens. Revel Greens is a CEA lettuce producer with locations in Minnesota, California, Texas, and Georgia. Their growth goal is to supply greens to the continental U.S. customer within 24 hours of harvest. The company is showing its commitment to breeding and technology by hiring Mo. He brings over 20 years of experience in life sciences and agricultural biotechnology research. He led a broad range of crop improvement applications and multiple R&D programs at both Benson Hill for 6 years and at Monsanto for 10 years prior. It was great to hear about his commitment to breeding and CEA. A self-proclaimed early CEA skeptic, as Mo learned more about the improvements in cost structure and also the possible gains to be made through breeding, he is now a CEA enthusiast. Let's join the conversation as Mo talks about his background. So tell me about your background and your current role.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm a molecular biologist by training. I did a PhD in Belgium and moved to Washington State University, where I did a postdoc there, working on cell biology. And throughout my career, since I joined Monsanto back in 2006, and later on with Benson Hill, I really had the opportunity to work in roles that span the whole gamut of crop improvements, particularly at the genetic side, but also the interaction of the genetics with the environment. And within Benson Hill, the other layer that also was really fascinating is really add the components of the data and the AI application to understanding really how the genetics interacts with its environment and how the varieties, you know, how do you pick varieties for a specific environment? Because at that time we're working with field crops, and so you have to adapt your crop to the environment rather than adapt the environment to the crop. Mm-hmm. And so that was kind of one, you know, very fascinating angle of really. I think the improvement really that has taken place over the last few years in certain technologies, in the machine learning approaches and data analytics really kind of stepped up the game in terms of how you look at crop improvements. So that those are the ranks that I come from. So I, as opposed to I guess many in the industry of the CEA, I come from a genetics rank. So I come from understanding of the variety and all that, and how other components affected. And I do believe that there is a, you know, substantial importance to that in the field.
So how did you get interested in CEA? I mean, that's kind of, I know both Benson Hill and Monsanto are much more row crop oriented. And so how did you kind of make that jump and what made you interested in it?
Yeah, I think it's a fascinating move. I got exposed deeply to the industry about maybe 2 or 3 years ago. Started working as part of the a consortium called you may be familiar with it, Precision Indoor Plants.
Yes. Oh, yeah. I forgot Benson Hill was part of that. Right.
That is correct. It's part of the Foundation for Food and Agriculture that's funded by Congress, and it requires matching funds from the industry. So Benson Hill was part of it. So I was representing Benson Hill on the executive committee of the consortium. And really the idea is that we as the industry, you know, come together to really think about topics that are really far fetching, looking, you know, far down the road into what can be possible with the new technologies, but also develop new technologies for crop improvements, and in this case, within PIP, it's really around the indoor, you know, growing discovery and building of the knowledge, and that's a really kind of the fascinating part about it, is that you're bringing together, you know, a number of technologies from a variety of different areas, from a genetic standpoint, from computer vision to you know, the understanding of the biochemistry for, you know, when you're talking about flavor compounds and all those things, all the way to robotics and data analytics aspect of it, and I think that amalgamation of the different, you know, technologies and just adds you know, one interesting component to it, and I love the fact also that I was one of the skeptics early on about really how this could work, you know, broadly speaking, beyond being just a niche of consumers, if you will. Mm-hmm. But it turned out to be that the technologies today are allowing actually the cost to come substantially from the lighting and things like that. I have a completely different view today than I had, you know, 2 or 3 years ago. And so that's how really I got interested into the space. And as I look into it a little further, I think the attractive nature of it, it goes beyond everything I'd imagined before. You know, here at River Greens, in glass houses and on ponds, we're able to, from a sustainability perspective, there's no match to it. I think we're estimating 90%, you know, less water same crop than you would do in the field, for example. There is no other growing, you know, in agricultural conditions where you can do that, 90% less water. Not only that, but you can set this thing up anywhere. You know, for decades we've been hearing about how arable land is shrinking, and it's becoming, you know, very problematic, you know, from that perspective, but also on the climate side of things. And
But, well, you're in California today, as we were talking about. And, you know, when you, I'm sure you've seen all the signs in the Central Valley about the water shortage. And, you know, there's, you definitely see that where you are today, that we have to do this with less water.
We definitely see that in here. And if I drive around and I see, you know, crops that are being irrigated with, you know, lots of water, is essentially, you know, some of it goes to the crop, a lot gets wasted. And so I think that's one of the huge attractive, you know, aspects of the CEA. I think the other piece also is the maximization of the footprint that you're using. We're seeding, harvesting, you know, every single day of the year, year round. It's not a two season crop. It's not even a three season crop. You know, it's every single day. So for whatever footprint you have of the land, you're using it, you know, maximally. We can grow, we have greenhouses out in Minnesota, you know, we can grow in January where it's, you know, minus 30, minus 40, we can grow in summer. So there is no limitation to where you can grow. There is no limitation to how much you can grow or how often. I think it adds up to the attractiveness part of it. Food safety is another aspect that I think, you know, really comes to the forefront as we hear a lot about the food recalls and all that. When it comes to lettuce, for example, a lot of that is essentially irrigation water, at least based on all indication. you know, because we can control everything indoor, we control, you know, when we bring in the water, it gets sterilized. There are techniques to sterilize water so that everything that comes in essentially into the pond is tested, is sterilized. It gets tested on a regular basis. We've tested the crop before it gets out. And so you have as much control as you can. So you're limiting your risk substantially compared to what you would do in the field. That those are really the, you know, major parts that attracted me to the field. Mm-hmm. And I think the third component, sustainability of safety and really the ability to focus on consumer traits. This is really closer to my heart because I'm a, you know, crop geneticist and all that. One of the challenges with growing crops in the field is you want to address the challenges of the field. That means the stresses of the heat, the cold, you know, you name it. And those are the traits in your breeding program you have to prioritize before you start thinking about flavor, taste, aroma, you name it, nutrition in general. And sometimes you have to make trade-offs, you know. Mm-hmm. You can have one or the other. You can't, you know, you can't have, you know, two or three. And in these cases, if you don't have the challenges with stresses and, you know, disease pressure and all the things you face in the field, then you don't have, then you can actually focus on packaging the genetics that is more around the consumer, what consumer really want.
Let's talk about that a little bit more. I love that. What are you focusing on and what kind of tools are you using? I mean, you come with such a great background of using all different kinds of tools, maybe that may be a little more accepted in some of the commodity crops than they are in produce. But what are you looking at as far as consumer traits?
I think the nutrition aspect of it, you know, looking at vitamins, looking at you know, minerals, and then there is the flavor, the taste part of it. There are biochemical pathways that you can you know, look for varieties or genetics that, you know, has better taste, better flavor. You can bring that into the genetics. And this is something that I'm trying to map out right now, working with, you know, in partnership with, you know, seed companies and all that, and trying to figure out whether this is something we want to do on our own or do it with somebody else. I think, you know, we're big on partnerships. We would rather do it with somebody.
Oh, good.
But I think the industry is a little bit right now not really fully committed. And I've talked about seed industry to the indoor, because nobody is really breeding specifically for the indoor. Even those who say they do, they're not doing it really the right way.
But do you think you'll end up having to build your own program around that, or how are you looking at it?
I'd rather not. So I think
it's a lot of work and a lot of people, right?
Yeah, you know, I don't think it is. You know, to be honest, you know, when you think about today with the technology that exists, that you can start a breeding program from scratch and bring varieties from seed banks and everything, and within, you know, 3-4 years, especially in crops we're talking about, the leafy greens and all that, in three years, you could get a variety out with the characteristics that you want. But again, I don't want to focus on that. I want to focus on, you know, getting the product that our consumers want first, and hopefully find somebody to work with to do this. Yeah. But if you don't, it's definitely on the table for us.
Yeah. Interesting. So I think there's probably a number of people out there that don't know about Revel Greens and kind of what you grow and where you're located and that type of thing. So if you could just give us a background on the company, that'd be great.
Oh, absolutely. Revel Greens started in 2017 on a 2.5 acres out in Minnesota, just outside of Minneapolis. And, you know, some of the co-founders have been working on the CEA for as far as I could, they can remember. So I think the art of growing indoor has been really perfected within the company before even the company started. And I think the one thing that attracted me to the company too is kind of the way they look at things ahead, the way they are thinking about how to take the company, you know, mainstream across the US. And what I mean by that 2.5 acres has grown into 10 in Minnesota, and there is plans to grow more into more acres over the next year or so. We've got a site now where I'm here in California, just 2 hours north of LA, where we are producing an operational on 16 acres. The facility has the capacity to grow up to 64. We're about to start renovating the next, you know, 16 acres essentially to get it to 32. And then just a couple of months ago, we made an acquisition outside of Athens, Georgia. That's already kind of servicing the southeast, and so that's a third site that's going to grow. We're thinking about the next year growing, expanding it. Right now, it's on a 5 acre. That's it's going to expand to 20 and then 40 later. And Texas, we're about to start construction. We've got the plans already in place for a site that'll start at 20 acres and grow ultimately into 100 acres over time. That's where we're going to place the R&D site, and potentially the headquarters will move into that as well. And so those are four locations spread across the country, as you can tell. There is intention to add at least a couple more sites in other, places, in other places where we're not operational today, or we don't have, sales. To really, the goal is to be located such that you can reach every single household within 24 hours from harvest to putting it on a shelf. And that's really the kind of mindset that really attracted me to Rebel Greens. Is go big. This is making a healthy, green, and sustainable food available to every household is not a small feat. And
no, not at all. Yeah. And I think it's interesting from a branding perspective. Are you use your own brand, right? It's you don't use store brands. You use a private.
We actually we do both. So we do private labels for some of our customers, but we have our own brand.
Yeah, I think it's hard as a consumer to go in and kind of figure out the space. When I go in and I look at the store and I'm like, where are these from and who grew this? And so I think, and they're so regional. And if you can do that local, but national, I think that's a really interesting model that you have. And what's your funding? How are you funded and kind of where are you in that space?
Yeah, we're funded primarily through Equilibrium. So they, funded a lot of, most of all our greenhouses and funded a lot of the work that has been, going on so far. So from that standpoint, I think we've been lucky really to have them on our side. I think we've got a really good relationship with them, and they really buy into our strategy and of going big, but also kind of being differentiated enough. One of the things that also differentiates the company is that we're not just focusing on the easy to grow baby spring mix or things like that, where we're tackling some of the challenges in, spinach, growing spinach, basil, kale, close to 18, different crops, essentially. And so it's not easy, growing spinach on a hydroponic. Everybody knows how difficult that is, and and we have I think the innovation mindset that also the company has really kind of sealed the deal for me is we've got some really recipes that we're able to grow spinach with no problem. That's actually being kind of about to be implemented right now. It's been in optimization for some time. So being a, I think that's really kind of the differentiation. Also, we're offering just a larger spread and different SKUs, if you will.
Yeah. And how do you look? I mean, your role is going to be to bring even more new products and differentiation. And so if you said earlier, it might take a short period of time, but if you came in right now and you said, okay, I'm going to develop something that has higher nutrition and better flavor, how long do you think it would take before you could get that to market?
I think in 3 to 4 years, you could get new varieties with, the traits that you're looking for. Essentially, what you have to do is you gotta go back to your gene banks. So my experience with Benson Health, for example, the soybean is well-known crop, right? Well, if you look at commodity crop, it's lost all the genes that have to do with the protein. The protein has been going down for many, many years. Because as yields are going up, protein is going down. The genetics that actually drives the level of protein gets lost. So you don't find it in many of the commercial varieties, you know, outside of, you know, Benson Hill, you know, does have some of those products. But you would find those in some germplasm in gene banks that have been put aside because they were not yielding. And so people kind of, you know, put them on the side. But, you know, the technology didn't exist at the time to kind of delineate the protein from yield. And sometimes it's just because, you know, people didn't look. The technology to measure protein every cycle of crossing just it was not, you know, easy to get a hold of, or not at least not at a cost effective. And so you didn't measure the protein, you just measured yield because you can, mm-hmm. you see. And so over time, if you don't measure it, you don't get it.
Right.
That's what you measure. So you measure yield, you're getting yield, you're losing protein. And a very similar thing, you can look across every crop, there is a similar trend. Tomato, you go to the old varieties, the heirloom and things like that. That's where the flavor and taste, you know, still exists. You know, the new varieties, they are shiny red, you know, beautiful, but they don't taste nearly as much. The genetic is there. It's not in the right germplasm today. And so you can go back, you gotta go back, essentially bring those back and then, you know, cross them and develop. If you have a genetics already, commercial genetics today, you know, it will be a much shorter time because all you need to do is basically bring those traits from older varieties into your commercial chassis, if you will. Mm-hmm. If you don't, that's not a deal breaker. I think you can build that genetics. And for small crops, like we talked about for the greens, you can do that in a much shorter amount of time. One of the aspects too with these crops, you know, these crops have not been developed to begin with, let alone for indoor growing.
Yeah, no one is spending the amount of time mapping everything out like they have corn and soy, right?
Exactly. Not a lot of money has, you know, from a research and development standpoint, has gone into it. And so the ability to take something from scratch and move it to where you're not just competitive, but you know, at least if you focus on traits that, you know, people have not focused on, you know, before, such as consumer traits, then I think you have the opportunity to move the needle on that, you know, much faster than you would do in a soybean or corn, for example. And then if you take it to the next step where you think, you know, I'm going to develop it actually for a CEA environment, not for the field, then you can see where you can make, you know, substantial jumps there versus if you're looking at developing it for the field and having all these other consumer traits that you wanted to develop. And so that's the... you know, the really the beauty of it.
So there are those in the industry who think that genetics don't matter and that it's all environment. So in the genetics by environment equation, that an indoor environment is everything and genetics don't matter at all. I disagree with that, but and it sounds like you kind of do too, but how do you, how far can we push? Let me ask a different way. How much do we know about the environment and how far we've kind of pushed these crops from an environmental point of view and a lighting and a water and all the other things we can make a recipe out of before we go to genetics? Or should we do genetics first, environment second, or kind of how do you look at it as you look at that equation?
I think all those things really you know, add value. Ultimately, you want all those elements to come together. But I am totally on the side of genetics has to be at the heart of it. You know, the light, everything, the environment, the lighting, everything you want is essential, but you gotta start from the genetics, because there's only so much you can push the genetics through, you know, artificial lighting and, you know, controlling the heck out of temperature and everything and the environment around it, nutrition and all that. But if it's not in the genetics, it's not in the genetics. That's just as simple as that.
You can't develop a pathway that doesn't exist by using a different light necessarily, right?
You got it. And I think the example that I provided earlier, when you take a variety, you know, which is the case today, a lot of, you know, almost that's everything that's been developed today in this space has been developed for the field. What you're trying to do in the field, you know, as a breeder, you're going to prioritize the things that are going to make your crop survive first. It's got to survive. If it tastes good and all that, it does survive. It doesn't matter, right? And so if you prioritize that, you prioritize, you know, the disease genetics and all that, what you're doing, you're compromising. You're not actually moving, you know, other things that have to do with everything that has consumer needs, essentially, from a nutrition to taste and everything. So that's number one. And so what people, you know, need to realize is there's a concept in breeding that's called linkage drug. Mm-hmm. That means if I'm taking, sometimes you may wanna, you absolutely have to have this disease, you know, QTL or gene. And if you have that, you have something attached to it that is either has to do either with, you know, like, you know, not a good taste, maybe an off flavor type of compound, or you know, drug, you know, it's slowing down the yield or something like that. And so if you take one, you're not getting B, period. Especially if they are very close on your, you know, chromosomes. and so in a case where I don't have to worry about that specific disease because it's a field disease, doesn't happen in greenhouse or, you know, a stress, I'm going to prioritize B. I'm not getting A, but I don't want it. I don't need it. That's the that's really, I think, how hopefully that paints the picture of the importance of genetics, what you can do with genetics to drive you know, whether it's yield, maximize your footprint on your system, whether it's a pond or you know, vertical, or and all the way to other traits that are important to, you know, to consumers.
Mm-hmm. Well, my last question, just kind of broadening out a little bit. So stepping back from CEA specific, you've been working in ag tech, as have I, before it was even called ag tech. And you were at Monsanto, as we talked about, and Vincent Hill. So just looking across your career kind of to date, what technologies have progressed faster than you expected and which ones haven't? And within breeding and outside breeding as well, and what do you feel like is still missing?
Yeah, I think some of the technologies that have, you know, moved really fast. The genome editing is definitely something that, you know, just maybe five, 8 years ago, you know, you barely heard about it, and it's like one of those things that is like way out there. You know, this new way this is going to work in, in a foreseeable future. And all of a sudden, now you got so many companies and startups around it. And it's making, you know, tremendous progress on the healthcare side of things, with, you know, some of the trials on a variety of different diseases and things like that. And in crops, it's also a technology that is likely to make, you know, significant improvement to the quality and taste of the crops. I think one of the things I just mentioned earlier on the linkage, genetic linkage, when you got a bad gene linked to closer to a good one. And you know, if you do that through breeding, you're not going to be able, you're taking the whole package. You're not going to take one and leave the other. But through genome editing, you can.
Do you see a place for genome editing in produce? There's, you know, I talk to a lot of people that are starting to look at it, or retailers are afraid of it. And how do you think that's going to play out in the markets that you're working in now and the use of genome editing?
You know, I think that's it's a question that, you know, it's yet to be figured out. I think it's going to come down to consumer, you know, perception and all that. At the end of the day, consumer is, you know, customer is king, as I say, right? Mm-hmm. But my feeling is that I think the technology in the past has been used in ways that really didn't benefit the consumer. Technologies in ag, you know, with this biotech or and people, you know, didn't see the purpose of it. But, you know, the hope is that if you're now using a technology that can actually, you know, bring back, you know, the nutrition into our food and bring back the taste and flavor, could that change the minds? And honestly, that's a question to be, that's something to be seen as we go forward. But what I do know is that it's definitely going to make a significant difference in our food system if the technology is able to to get past the hurdles of perception. And so we'll see. Right now, I think there's a lot to be done through breeding by itself, just to get, again, because you know some of these crops really still have a lot of the genetics that's sitting in shelves in gene banks that hasn't been used or, you know, put away because they didn't yield well in the field. And if you go back to it and bring, you can definitely make significant changes there, with or without genome editing. But I do think that genome editing can speed up that process and get, you know, some of the traits might be the only answer to it.
Yeah. What about any technologies that you thought at one point, boy, this is going to really make a difference, and then they didn't really work out? Anything over your career like that you've seen?
You know, I don't know that there is a technology that really didn't, you know, think people can argue whether, you know, GMO did or didn't. Clearly, yeah, all I can say about that is, you know, when you look at corn and soybean, 80 to 90% is GMO in the U.S. today. What does that tell you? That the farmer does like the technology. It works for them. It doesn't work for the consumer because they don't see the prices really coming down. You wouldn't know if we didn't have that. Maybe the prices would be, you know, like astronomical today, but you wouldn't know. You don't have a control.
Yeah, exactly.
That's one. And outside of that, as a consumer, I'm not getting any, you know, does it taste better now? Because the focus was on the farm. It's farm productivity. It wasn't on the consumer. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there is, you know, definitely huge successes in that space, that unfortunately the the perception didn't go along. And that's fine. I think sometimes, you know, that's how life goes. You know, technologies come and go. But I don't know that there is a technology that, you know, came and, you know, completely failed. I think every single thing, every time you there's a stepping stone at everything. What is really, really cool now is the ability to put all that, you know, thing together and, you know, from a data aspect to genetics to physiology to computer vision, and bringing that together in a way that you can analyze it live, you can look at it back over time, or, you know, even, you know, prediction in the future around your harvest, around your timing of the year, and things like that is just really fascinating.
Yeah, there's just so many tools that we can use now that are pretty amazing and how they're going together, you know. And I think sometimes it's like a circle when I look at some of the technologies I've worked on. I worked in biocontrols the early part of my career, and they didn't work very well. Like I can see why people didn't adopt them, because they didn't work very well. But now, for lots of reasons, you know, we have better ways of testing them. We have better ways of applying them, you know, through precision application. So I think it's biocontrols time, you know, and I think some of the technologies, that's just kind of how they go, you know, it's a circle, and you have to develop other things around it. So it'll be interesting, I think, with genome editing, where consumers have competing interests. You know, we have to adapt to climate change. We have to, you know, we have to use less water. We have to have less food waste. You know, there's a lot of consumer interests that kind of compete with, I don't want to use that technology. And so I think, you know, you'll be in a good position. We'll have to talk in 5 years, you know, to see like what you decided for your company makes sense, because you have all these competing interests of consumers. And, you know, genome editing might be the best way to solve that. And consumers may embrace that. You know, we'll just have to see where that goes, right?
Yep. Yep.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for your time. This has been a great conversation, and I look forward to watching your career and what you do and make an impact on CEA. So thank you.
That's it for this episode of PMA Takes on Tech. Thanks for allowing us to serve as your guide to the new world of produce and technology. Be sure to check out all our episodes at pma.com and wherever you get your podcasts. Please subscribe, and I would love to get any comments or suggestions of what you might want me to take on. For now, stay safe, eat your fruits and vegetables, and we will see you next time.